Hello and welcome to The Rest is History, our latest bonus episode. And Tom, we meet in the aftermath of the release of our American Revolution series. A very exciting moment for us, something we've been planning for a year.
Yes, so you should all have had them, all four episodes. Always interesting to see who gorges on them at once and then
moans for 2 weeks.
that there are no more to come. So we recorded those last week, didn't we? In a heroic burst from the great Adam Smith.
Yeah, we did.
Who was as good in this as he was in the American Civil War. And that's the highest praise that I can give, really.
It's very high praise. So there were two brilliant impersonations in those episodes. He did a guy called Isaac Barre, who was an Irish member of the House of Commons. Remember that, Tom?
Yes.
He was shouting about whether or not the colonies had come to sort of, they'd reached their wealth and prestige through Britain's efforts or through their own. And Adam did that very strongly. And I thought, that's going to take some topping. But then in you came with John Adams.
Yeah.
John Adams, the T.
Yeah.
This is the most sublime moment. And I thought it absolutely captured the spirit of the founding fathers in a way that I hadn't heard before.
I think it kind of makes me think it's a great shame that Americans don't still speak like that.
Well, some would say they do. But
they don't speak like they're from Devon.
No. I mean, there may be an argument that John Adams didn't perhaps speak like that.
So now you come out with it.
So have you seen the HBO John Adams miniseries?
No, I haven't.
I cannot recommend it highly enough. It is excellent. And it actually really, one of the things it really captures is the Britishness and specifically the Englishness of colonial America. So many of the characters, so they're almost all played by British actors. So Benjamin Franklin is Tom Wilkinson. Thomas Jefferson is Stephen Delane, I think it is.
Oh, Stephen Delane is brilliant. He did the best Hamlet I've ever seen.
Really?
He was superb. His career never really kind of took off in quite the way that I watched that and I thought, this is the best actor I've ever seen.
Right.
And he's done great stuff. He was in Game of Thrones.
He was in Game of Thrones.
The Cazalets. But he's a brilliant, brilliant actor. I think the most underrated actor.
Right. Well, he's Jefferson and he's brilliant as Jefferson. He's very Thomas More-like. As Jefferson. He's very sort of intense, but he speaks like that.
Okay, well, I'm going to watch it.
And Paul Giamatti is John Adams, and he's really one of the only ones who does an American accent. He speaks with a kind of soft version of his own accent.
Well, because to be fair, Adam said in the episode that actually the Boston Yankees do have a kind of, that's where the American accent is coming from.
Right, yeah.
So it's probably wrong of me to go full Devon.
It was fun though.
But I'm much better at doing a Devon accent than I am a Yankee accent.
So I don't know when this bonus comes out, whether, you know, the Rest is History's audience will have halved or at least tumbled.
Across America.
We're slightly anxious, aren't we, that the revisionist spirit of those episodes. But actually, I was listening back to the first one today, and Adam is very, very, he's very precise, and he's very methodical in the way he dissects the politics. He's brilliant on politics, isn't he, on the politics of the 1770s.
I think we discussed, didn't we? Because it's we've done so many episodes since we recorded those. It's all a blur.
Yeah.
But I seem to remember that we did discuss the paradox of the fact that the kind of the very revisionist take in America at the moment.
The 1619 Project, yeah.
The 1619 Project sees the American War of Independence as having been all about slavery. Paradoxically gives the British Empire slightly...
Yeah, of course. Because they take this thing called Dunmore's Proclamation terribly seriously in the 1619 Project and the sort of younger, woker American historians argue that the revolutionaries are motivated by anxiety that the British are going to abolish slavery. But older historians say this is tosh, nonsense. And I think Adam is kind of in the older historian camp, isn't he?
Well, it does seem, I mean, it palpably seems tosh because the British aren't abolishing it in the Caribbean,
exactly. Yeah.
And Dunsmore actually goes off, I think he becomes governor of Barbados or something.
Yeah. It was a desperation measure by the British, wasn't it? It was like an ultimate threat.
Yeah.
And press the nuclear button.
It's equivalent of the Dutch kind of blowing up the dikes, you know, when they get invaded. It's a kind of suicide policy.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I knew nothing at all about the American Revolution before we...
Me neither.
...started this. And we were talking at the beginning about the sort of black wholeness of it in Britain. I was thinking, Adam and I were both at Cambridge doing our PhDs. And we were part of a brilliant American history program for graduate students, the best in Britain. And there was a talk every single Monday night. Quite often, quite prestigious academic would be flown over from the US, or sometimes from Britain, but often flown over from the US to address us, you know, to do a seminar. And in all that time, I'm not sure I ever heard anybody talk about the American Revolution. It was always the Civil War, a Reconstruction, masses on Reconstruction, and tons on the civil rights movement.
Nothing about about the colonial period?
A tiny bit about the colonial period, but by and large it was that period, the late 18th century, and especially the politics of it, was really kind of neglected.
So I'd never studied anything about colonial America until I did Dominion. So I wrote about the Mayflower and I wrote about the Declaration of Independence. But obviously I had a particular, you know, there were particular aspects of that I was interested in, namely the Christian aspects of it. I had a vague sense of the battles, Burgoyne and,
right, you know, Saratoga, Yorktown,
Cornwallis, and a vague sense of that. And something about Washington crossing the Delaware, which was a song that was in the Muppets.
Oh, right. Is that right?
Lydia the Tattooed Lady.
Right. You know, I was only watching the Muppet movie last night, Tom, the 2011 reboot.
Right. So I think Kermit sings it, or maybe it's Scooter. I can't remember.
Right.
Washington crossing the Delaware.
I'm a very big fan of the Muppets, Tom, I'll be honest with you.
So that basically was the limit of what I knew. I mean, I knew the Roman stuff.
Yeah.
The influence that Roman and Greek historians had on it. But kind of very, it was like, you know, there were just certain aspects of it that I knew and everything else was just blur, an absolute blur. So I thought, as so often when doing these episodes, areas that I don't really know much about, it's a process of self-education. It's brilliant. You kind of come out of it knowing how everything fits in.
Exactly. I love that, putting the jigsaw together. It's one of the great joys of doing the podcast, isn't it? Theo says in the chat, famously, curriculums can't cover everything, which is true. But I do think it is really interesting that this seismic moment in British history is absent from our imagination, really. I think most people have vaguely heard of the Boston Tea Party, but I don't think most ordinary people have heard of any single battle.
I think it, in a way, maybe it's tribute to the success of the propaganda battle on both sides, which I hope comes across in the series, a sense that this is a civil war. It's a debate about what it is to be English. It's a debate about the legacy of the 17th century in particular. And what becomes the United States of America lays claim to that Republican tradition. And in Britain, that is kind of essentially washed out. So, you know, we think of British history in terms of kings and queens succeeding each other, say the Victorian period, the Edwardian period, whatever. It's America that lays claim to the Republican tradition. And so perhaps that's just why we don't kind of integrate it into the way that we think about history.
I think two other things. One is that, as Theo says, curriculums can't cover everything, but to British consumers of history, the story that eclipses the American Revolution is obviously the French Revolution and Britain's role in the subsequent wars. So Trafalgar, Waterloo. You know, if you've got time for a sort of late 18th century hero or a story, it's the story of Trafalgar.
Well, also we do lose,
but I think crucially, we don't lose the empire. And so that means it's seen as a blip rather than a trauma.
And I think also it's seen as something that was inevitable.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. So even Andrew Roberts' biography of George III is very, very pro-George III. He makes a very strong case about George III having been completely traduced by history. The Declaration of Independence is a libel on George III, all this sort of stuff. And he goes through it pretty painstakingly. And yet he then says, however, the American independence was inevitable. And the mistake was just not to recognize that the colonies were now so rich and so independent-minded that they were going to go their own way at some point anyway. And on that topic, just before we talk about the other episodes we have recorded, we have one question about sort of preemptive question from Jesse B. Who is your favorite and your least favorite U.S. founding father and why? Tom?
Benjamin Franklin is my favorite. I love his experiments with kites and lightning. I like the fact that he worked as a printer's apprentice in St. Bartholomew the Great in Smithfield, the church.
Yeah.
I like his kind of homely wisdom. I like his cheery kind of Mr. Pickwick physique.
Very Pickwickian. Yeah.
Yeah. So all those reasons. He looks great on the dollar bill. So absolutely thumbs up. He's completely my number one. And obviously my least favorite is Thomas Jefferson, because he's a massive, stinking, uptight hypocrite of the worst kind.
So Tom, I totally agree with you about Jefferson. He's my least favorite. He is an absolutely shameless hypocrite. And on top of that, his vision of the sort of the independent yeoman farms and all that being left alone by government, I think is idiocy, naive, pernicious, and wrong. I think my favorite is probably Hamilton, because he stands for strong, efficient government, a national bank, war with the French, jewels, lots of things that I approve of. So he's my choice.
And he's in a musical, isn't he?
I've never seen the musical.
No, neither have I.
Never seen it. But he is played in the John Adams series by Rufus Sewell.
Oh, is he?
Very plausible casting. Rufus Sewell, who does a full, he makes your John Adams accent look strained. So Mr. Hamilton speaks like that.
Well, I really must watch it. Because he was a very good Charles II.
He was,
Rufus Sewell. So he's played a range of interesting historical characters. And he was a Nazi, wasn't he?
He was a Nazi in The Man in the High Castle.
In the High Castle.
And he was a Sicilian cop or something like that.
Yeah, he's very good. Very good.
He's very good cheekbones.
So that's our first question. We will have some questions. But just before we get onto them, the other episodes that we've done, so we have done two episodes on 60s fashion.
Oh, yeah. I completely forgot about those, actually.
They were great. You seemed lacking in self-confidence. You weren't committing yourself to the game.
What? Well, I wasn't committing myself.
No, you kept saying, oh, I don't think, you know, is this a subject that's interesting enough? And it absolutely was. It was brilliant.
Oh, that's good to know.
You are in top form. And it's peak Sam Brooke. It's taking the trends that affect people in everyday life and making them seem vivid and relevant and fascinating and opening your eyes to things that you've completely taken for granted. Tour de force, Dominic. Tour de force.
Tom, what is going on? What are you about to ask when this is over?
Like, nothing.
Will I do some charity cricket gig with you?
I really, really enjoyed it. I knew that I'd enjoy it. I'd been pushing you to do it.
You had.
But I thought it was great. And there are two episodes, and all I can say is that I would cheer if you've made it four.
Oh, fantastic.
So mini skirts, all the, you know, beads, yeah. Joss sticks, everything. 60s fashion, we've got it. So that's fun.
So I'll tell you what we've done this morning that was great, a great laugh. We've recorded a podcast about the Habsburgs with a Habsburg Archduke. So this is Tom's wheeze. And actually, I was dubious, but it's completely paid off, Tom, hasn't it?
Yeah, it was great fun. So Eduard Habsburg, who is the Hungarian ambassador to the Holy See. And actually, he's good mates with the Pope, I think.
He is. I started well, and I thought I was on track for a Habsburg honor. But actually, by the end of it, it was pretty clear that he thinks I'm going to hell.
Yes, whereas I complimented on him on his chin.
You did, on his jaw, his Habsburg jaw.
Said he had a very good jaw. It's not kind of protruding.
So it's the whole sweep of Habsburg history. And what he's written this book about what lessons people can learn and how they can model themselves on the most famous and most celebrated family in all European history. And some of the lessons are probably more bonkers than others. But they're all good fun, and they allow us to sort of do the whole sweep of Habsburg history. Maria Theresa, Marie Antoinette, Franz Joseph, Maximilian, Charles V. They're all in there, aren't they?
They're all in there, yeah.
It's a massive sort of panorama.
And the other one we did was Catherine of Siena, St. Catherine of Siena.
Now that, Tom, that, you were being very nice about 60s fashion, but Catherine of Siena, that was so interesting and so dark.
This is a 14th century saint who's basically the medieval Greta Thunberg.
Yeah.
She becomes incredibly famous a kind of big influencer on geopolitics, but is also, yes, so Theo has just flashed up. The title for the episode is The Blood-Drinking Bride of Christ, which is an entirely accurate description of her.
Yeah.
Because she does marry Christ and she does drink blood.
Yeah. Exciting scenes.
Yeah, and it's all about the way that women are seen, their relationship to food in the Middle Ages. I think a very interesting topic. So that is coming as well.
We're doing loads of recording at the moment, aren't we? Because this week we're doing Gladiators, Pompeii, Love Island, and the Library of Alexandria. Three of those episodes are like each other, and one is not, and that's Love Island. And we have been choosing our candidates, and we can't give anything away.
No. But it's the same format that Katie, my older daughter, has given us some Love Island archetypes, and we have to find figures from history who map onto them.
Yeah.
And we will be introducing two friends of the show, so figures who have appeared in previous episodes, into the Love Island, historical Love Island house. So that's all great. I think that's enough previewing. Should we look at some of the questions?
Yes. So this is a question for you, I think, Tom. It's from Ethelfrith. In the mid to late 18th century, we seem to see an important cultural turn from hedonism to Puritanism. In the Christian world, this was seen to be represented by the Great Awakening, Methodism, and the abandonment of the Baroque. In the Islamic world, the birth of Wahhabism and the conservative swing in the Ottoman court. How do we go from powdered wigs, bright blue waistcoats with golden buckles and stockings to black and grey dour outfits that we associate with the 19th century? So, Tom, it's about the great shift. It's funny because there's a slight collision of periods, I think, in that question. But it's about cultural shifts from hedonism to Puritanism, from flamboyance to austerity. I mean, that must have happened in the ancient world as well, did it?
We talked about the change from golden buckles and stockings to black and grey dour outfits in our episode on fashion in the age of Jane Austen. And actually, yeah, it's all down to Beau Brummell. So it's his adoption of that kind of style that establishes what will be the uniform for men, basically right the way up into the present day. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily reflective of a kind of Puritanism. I think it's to do with the material dynamics of the evolving fashion industry and the ability of Beau Brummell, he's the first kind of trendsetter. He's the first mass market influencer. And the Regency period is not in any way a Puritan period.
No.
It's the age of George IV and Lord Byron. And certainly in Britain, the Puritanism kicks in with the Victorians.
I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that the Puritan and the Cavalier, if you like, those are threads that run right through British society. Then neither of them ever die out. They're always there from the 17th century onwards, aren't they? I mean, you could have found people who were very austere, even at the height of the Restoration, or, you know, you'd have found people who yearned for the good old days of the 1650s. But I suppose there are fashions that come and go, intellectual and cultural fashions, determined largely by the court, I suppose.
Well, I'm not sure it is determined by the court from the 16th century onwards, 17th century. I think it is determined by, and Dominic, you know what I'm going to say, Christian notions of morality, the urge to repentance, the urge to self-reformation, the urge to kind of rein in your appetites, mm-hmm. that are kind of fundamental to Christian teaching. And yet then you get periods where this seems too repressive, too oppressive, and people kick back against it. So the archetype of that is the age of Charles II coming after the age of Oliver Cromwell. But it's a pattern that you see repeating again and again. So the Regency being followed by the Victorian period would be the same. I would say that we actually now are living through, an equivalent of the Commonwealth or the Victorian period, in that we are reacting against a period of kind of hedonism. So I think the 60s, 60s, 70s, 80s, maybe even to the 90s, was a very hedonistic period where morality was relaxed. And now the sense of the importance of moral standards being upheld and the determination to punish people who don't stick to kind of moral frameworks is coming right back in, as it did in the 1650s, as it did in the 1830s and 40s. I don't know whether you'd agree with that.
I couldn't agree with you more, Tom. I totally agree with you. I often think about my generation, some of whom are listeners to this podcast, a university in the early 1990s, how unusual it was to be idealistic, to be politically terribly committed. The very high premium that was placed on being ironic and being in a degree of ironic distance from things, the sense of I mean, this is the 1990s, so it's the kind of heyday of loaded lad culture, all of that sort of stuff.
But also, I think about people kind of going around the country in the late 80s and 90s, when I was at university, people were going around the country to take ecstasy and dance in fields. Now they're going around it basically to protest against oil. And I think that absolutely sums up the contrast in mood.
But the funny thing is that sometimes I talk to people and they say, well, history is moving in this direction. You know, history is the youngsters are, you know, they will be in charge one day and they will set the tone and everything will. And I always say, but you're forgetting that there'll be other people after them who will react against them.
It's a pendulum. It's a constant pendulum.
The people who are currently 10, 5, 1, when they come along, they're not necessarily going to be more woke than the people now. They will actually roll their eyes, sigh, laugh, scoff at, you know, the 30-year-old's boring ways, and they will move back to the other, as has always happened in history.
But I think that, you know, just to repeat, I think that this is a cycle that you see throughout early modern Western history, right the way up to the present, determined by the influence and the counter-reaction against fundamentally kind of Christian notions of morality.
Yeah.
So the other one that Aethelfrith mentions, the birth of Wahhabism, so that's the rise of what we might call fundamentalist Islam. I mean, that is really a reaction to changes in the Ottoman Empire that in turn are influenced by the emergence of the printing press. Wahhabism is then turbocharged by the intrusion of the Western powers, beginning with Napoleon, but throughout the 19th into the 20th century. And I think for the non-Christian world, the rhythms are basically, it's how do you deal with Western influence? That's how it's framed. So the very word fundamentalism is originally applied to Protestantism. And so in the Muslim world, the cycle has been, do you adapt Islam to Western influence? So do you say, oh, you know, of course Islam is compatible with, I don't know, feminism or the abolition of slavery or whatever. Or do you say, no, it isn't. We've got to get back to the way things were, which the darkest and most yeah. brutal expression recently was the Islamic State. But I think it's very, very difficult for people, say, in the Muslim world to return to a world in which there is no Western influence. You're constantly being influenced by it or reacting against it, but it's Western influence that is the kind of determining factor.
Okay. I mean, that's a fascinating topic and one that will be a great subject actually for an episode in itself. And now another fascinating topic for you, and this is a gift for you, Tom. It's from Mick Jones. Considering the Ashes, so this is the great cricket showdown between England and Australia. If you're neither English nor Australian, and if you're not from the Commonwealth, this will just be babble to you, so you can go make a cup of tea for the next 5 minutes.
Well, no, I don't think so, because I think that I think Mick is right that the history is incredibly important.
We haven't asked this question yet, Tom.
Oh, yes,
I haven't asked this question. Okay. Considering the Ashes, Mick says, how much does history play a part in creating a great sporting rivalry?
I think a huge part. So the reason why the rivalry between England and Australia in cricket has, I think, would be of interest to anyone, is that it is the oldest continuous sporting rivalry that exists anywhere in the world. The name, the Ashes, it has a kind of romantic allure because it's England are playing Australia at the Oval at a time where it is assumed that England will defeat Australia as a matter of course, because the English have invented the game and the Australians are colonial upstarts. Amazingly, the Australians win. And so there is this mock obituary delivered saying that...
That's in 1882.
1882. The body of English cricket will be cremated and the ashes sent to Australia. And so these are the ashes that we fight over. But Dominic, I mean, it's not just cricket. You know, it's the basis of all sports, I think. Individual rivalries. I mean, so if it's boxing or tennis or whatever, I mean, that's kind of provides the lifeblood of sport, but also of course football. I mean, football is nothing if not ancestral rivalries, is it?
No, you're absolutely right. So Jonathan Wilson, a friend of the Rest is History, had a column in The Guardian or The Observer, I'm not sure which, this weekend, talking about football clubs and about the tension within sport at the moment. Because of course, football clubs are the vehicles, not just for business now, but geopolitical vehicles. So the most famous examples are the current European champions, Manchester City. They were bought by Abu Dhabi. Paris Saint-Germain, the French champions, bought by Qatar. Newcastle United by Saudi Arabia. And so football clubs have become the vehicles for Middle Eastern political rivalries. And yet, of course, as Jonathan points out in his article, they're also the supreme embodiment of kind of 19th century municipal loyalty. Which is how they're still perceived by most of their English supporters. And so that's a brilliant example of sport as a window into the changing patterns of kind of economic and political dominance. Anyway, to go back to Australia, the big thing in Australia and England is the Bodyline Tour of the 1930s, isn't it? So that's the point at which actually Australia is defining itself as a separate nation. Post First World War.
Yeah, I think credibly, you could say it's Gallipoli and Bodyline that does much to kind of create a sense of Australian nationhood as something distinct from being aligned with the mother country.
And so the Bodyline Tour, for those people who don't know, the England team arrived in Australia and they were perceived to have played in an over-aggressive, unsporting manner because they target Australia's best batsman by bowling directly at his body.
And a cricket ball is very hard. And if it hits you, at 90, 95 miles an hour, then you really know
it can injure you.
It could kill you. It has killed batsmen.
Yeah.
So it's very dangerous. And of course, Bodyline is basically the only time that the English have not been good sports. And from that time on, we have upheld sportsmanship unfailingly, unlike Australia.
Well, you will know yesterday the Australians absolutely disgraced themselves, didn't they? Is cheated too strong a word?
No. So this is, again, I can't begin to explain this for people who don't know anything about it. But Australia played within the rules, but perhaps not within the spirit of the game. But what I would also add is that a particular England player, who is actually my favourite England player, a bowler called Stuart Broad, made a great song and dance about it. And he's notorious for also playing within the rules of the game, but not necessarily the spirit. So it's all great fun. And this will now become part of, again, of the fabric of Ashes folklore, the great rivalry. So it's tremendous. Two last questions. So this is a very quick one for you from Reticus. In the marvellous Hulu show, The Great, which is about Catherine the Great, bizarre and violent things often occur, followed by a shrug and someone says, "This is Russia," or something along those lines. What is it about Russia that sets it apart even from other East European countries? Is violence endemic to Russia, even as a modern nation? You have 2 minutes to answer those questions.
Well, do you know what? I want to take a tiny bit longer because it's such an interesting question. So yes, this is clearly coming off the live stream that we did last week about Russian coups. A sense of Russia. I mean, this is what people still say now. You see it always in commentary about Putin and about the war in Ukraine and so on. A couple of things. So one element of this is that Russia is violent. I mean, there are all sorts of Twitter accounts set up showing people wrestling bears or shooting themselves in the head or driving into lakes.
Only in Russia.
Mad and incredibly suicidal and violent behavior. The other is the idea that the Russians are addicted to autocracy, that they need a strong hand, all this sort of thing. I think what I would say is what makes Russia different from other Eastern European states is that Russia is by definition a frontier society. So actually the parallel is not necessarily between Russia and Poland or Russia and, you know, Hungary or something, but a better parallel is probably Russia and the United States. So Russia is...
It's also an empire to a degree, isn't it?
Exactly right, yeah. So it's never a nation state. It's always an empire. I mean, even now, inside the Russian Federation, I mean, the name is the clue, there are loads of kind of federal subjects. There are dozens, scores of them that have a degree of self-government that often correlate to kind of ethnic divisions, or there are Muslim Tatars in Kazan or whatever, or in Dagestan, or there are, you know, loads of different peoples in Central Asia, in Siberia. So violence was always there in Russia. It was always an unusually violent society because it was a frontier society. It also had this tradition of autocracy inherited from, or what they believe they inherited it from, the Eastern Roman Empire, from the Byzantine Empire, don't they? The idea of Moscow as the third Rome. Russia economically was way behind Western Europe in particular for centuries. A peasant society, a society with serfs. So, you know, its trajectory was always different from that of, you know, France or Spain or something. You couldn't really make a comparison between the two. And actually the comparison with the kind of Wild West in America, I think, is much better. The only danger with all this is you end up completely orientalizing Russia.
And also being very determinist as well.
Very determinist. So you sort of say, well, democracy could never have worked in the 1990s. You know, they were always going to want a strong ruler. I think they always were going to need, well, they'd wanted a stable government, which is why they're nostalgic for the Brezhnev era, because it seems to have been a period of unusual stability. And it's actually why a lot of people, even now, like Vladimir Putin in Russia, because they think he is a guarantee of stability. As you say, it's too determinist. It's too sort of, oh, that's Russia. You know, they love autocrats in Russia. They love dictators. So I think it's a tiny bit too simplistic these days. But I think there is an interesting sense that there has become more pronounced in the last 10 or 20 years among Russians. They've come to believe in their own exceptionalism in a way that they didn't really necessarily think of it in the 1990s. So now they do think. They've defined themselves, haven't they, against the West.
Yeah.
They say, we're not Western, we're Eurasian.
Well, but not all, at all.
No, there's a minority who want to be part of it, but I think they are a tiny minority, actually.
Okay.
Here's a question on the same or similar inspiration about coups. We asked talked about coups last week. Do you think a coup or revolution can only succeed?
This is from Hishino One.
Can only succeed with the support either of a foreign power or the army of the state. So Tom, in Rome, coups often worked. There were lots of coups backed by the Praetorian Guard.
Yeah, so palace coups.
I mean, as long as you had the Praetorian Guard on side.
Well, the issue for the Romans was that the emperors were not kings. And so even as Rome became an absolute autocracy, there was always this sense that it remained a republic. So that's the kind of the tension. I mean, right the way up to the time of Justinian, there are still kind of lip service being paid to the republican traditions. So that does make the transfer of power always a very dangerous time. And it means that the removal of an emperor is always a kind of standing temptation for someone who'd be next.
Because there's no legitimacy issue. Is that right? So it's not like with a king where you get rid of Richard II, Henry IV comes in, and there's always the sense of him being a usurper. You don't get that with Roman emperors, do you?
The idea is kind of baked in that the best person should be emperor. But obviously, if you're a very successful general on the frontier with a large quantity of troops and you think that the guy back in Rome is useless, then maybe you think you're the best person and it's your duty to go and topple it. But yes, I mean, to answer the question, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you do need military backing. I've said that military backing is a sine qua non, as we saw recently.
Of course it is, yeah. I don't think the foreign issue is so important, actually. I think you can have a coup and it can work even if you have very little foreign support, if you don't care about foreign support. I think the key thing is the army. I think the key thing is the people who have the monopoly of violence. If you win them over, you can do anything. And actually, we touched on this in the live stream about the 1991 coup, for example. I mean, this is such a Sam Brookian thing to say. I feel like I'm just playing sort of my own cliche bingo. But basically, eliminate your opponents, do what you have to do, do it very quickly and do it utterly ruthlessly so you terrify other people, and then you will win. You know, if you kill everyone who stands against you, you will win. Now, the funny thing is that often people are too reluctant to do that. So they were reluctant in August 1991. If they had killed Yeltsin on day one, or locked him up,
they'd done it.
They probably have won.
So, business lessons from the rest is history. We should do that, shouldn't we? We should seriously do that. How to get ahead. Lessons of history.
So should do that.
Very last question. Just a quick one. This is from Zepby. Is the Neil Price Viking magic episode just a supreme piece of gaslighting? Is it actually ever happening? Has it already happened and I've just blanked? I'm so psychologically damaged over it that I went and bought Neil's book on the Vikings, Children of Ash and Elm, and brought it home. I need to find that I already had a copy on the shelf and have no memory of buying it.
Tom, are we heading for the first anniversary of recording that episode?
No, I don't know why it hasn't gone out. It's a great episode and it is definitely coming out over the next couple of months.
Couple of years. It's
definitely in the schedule.
I think what happens is we have these scheduled debates and we'll be mulling up. The other thing is we do too many series. And the series end up dominating.
Yeah, because basically we think this will be one episode and then it turns out to be two, three or four because it's such an interesting one.
Exactly. And so that ends up hogging spots on the schedule. And so quite often we're weighing up different things and say, Viking sorcery? I'm like, no, maybe hold that one in reserve for a little bit longer.
We scheduled it a while back and then we did the episode on American witchcraft.
That's right.
And we thought we can't have two programs with guests on sorcery going out.
Yeah.
So it seems like that, but it is definitely coming. It is definitely coming.
I mean, it's coming. It's recorded. It's literally the MP3 or whatever. It's just sitting there on Theo's computer waiting to be unleashed on the world.
But I kind of like the idea that it's become a legendary.
Exactly.
The bootleg show that's yet to go out. So it will be coming.
Well, not as legendary, Tom, as the Act of Union. I think that's the real legend, isn't it, among rest is history. Yeah.
Yes, what has happened to that?
Rest is history, aficionados. So as you say, we've got lots of fun things to look forward to. Gladiators, Pompeii, we're doing the Taj Mahal, we've got British fascism, we've got...
Amsterdam coming, History of Amsterdam, Soissons Wheat, so...
In Paris.
The Venom or the events in Paris in 1968. So lots to come.
Lots of fun things to come. And we've got one more live stream, I think, before I go on holiday. So that live stream, as of now... is scheduled for the 18th of July. So that's a little a little heads up. And the next day, Tom, we're recording two episodes on the fall of Constantinople.
So upset about that.
Subject that you're very, very conflicted about, aren't you?
I'm not conflicted. I don't want to do it. It's too sad.
All right, well.
You've kept suggesting it and I kept saying, no, I can't. It's too soon. Too soon.
Yeah, too soon. Right. So lots to look forward to. And thank you, as always, for your support. Thank you for listening. And those of you who are still left after the American Revolution episodes, so that's our British listeners, Canadians, other loyal peoples, we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.